Hello, listeners of the Nighttime Podcast. Before we get to tonight's episode, I want to take a moment to reintroduce my Patreon group. If you've never checked it out, the Patreon site allows you to support the show for $1 a month. The funds raised via Patreon are then reinvested back into the show to help it both grow and improve. In exchange for your support, you'll also gain access to the monthly bonus content that I release via a private RSS feed. If you'd like to learn more, or if you choose to support me in the creation of the Nighttime Podcast, please visit patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focusing on the fringe of Atlantic Canada. Mysteries, crime, the paranormal, and the weird. All under the soft glow of the moon. Welcome. Now, here is your host, Jordan Boneparty.
As the month of February descended upon me, I couldn't help but feel the air thickening with the feelings one associates with love. Finding myself intoxicated by this cocktail of emotion, I became inspired to dedicate this month's episodes to the Valentine's story I hold above all others I've ever heard. I want to caution you, though. This story's violent, and incredibly so. It takes place in the early 80s in a small coal mining town on Cape Breton Island. The story concerns a Valentine's Day dance a group of the town's teenagers plan to hold. When the mayor and police chief forbid them from continuing with the event, this group continue their plans and hold the party in secret. To the great misfortune of the townspeople, a long-whispered legend comes true when a maniac dressed in mining gear begins a violent murder spree. In the end, the scene of the crime will stretch from a downtown laundromat all the way to the deepest, darkest depths of the coal mine the town sits upon. Fortunately for everyone involved, this story is a work of fiction. Tonight, we'll be discussing the 1981 slasher film, My Bloody Valentine. For any of you following me on social media, it won't be a surprise when I tell you that I'm a massive fan of horror films. I think my love for the genre was the result of an experience I had when I was 7. This was at a local VHS rental store in Cape Breton where the actor C.J. Graham was holding an autograph session. He's best known for having played Jason Voorhees in Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives. Sadly, the photos we took that day of me wearing the hockey mask holding a machete to his neck were lost in a flood years ago. Now, this brush against the big leagues of horror was certainly a formative personal experience, but for my home, Cape Breton Island, our status as a place where great horror films happen had already been firmly in place when 7-year-old me clumsily pulled Jason's mask over my backwards hat. Our story starts in the early 1980s during what is considered to be the golden age of the slasher-style horror film. If this term is new to you, slasher films are the ones that involve a group of people being stalked and murdered by a violent psychopath. Some notable examples would be the box office hits Friday the 13th, Halloween, and A Nightmare on Elm Street. So given the audience's appetite at the time, many filmmakers took stabs at the genre. But what may be a surprise to many members of my community is that one of the most gruesome, creative, ambitious, and all-around awesome slasher films was filmed right here in Nova Scotia. The 1981 film My Bloody Valentine was shot in and around the Sydney Mines area of Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. During its 36-year history, the movie has gained a cult following, spawned a popular 3D remake, and benefited from the popular director Quentin Tarantino going on record proclaiming it to be his favorite horror film. I alluded to the movie's plot in the introduction to this film, but I'll now make it more clear. The film is set in a small mining town named Valentine Bluffs. Despite the name, a violent murder spree in the years prior to the events in the film put an end to the annual tradition of celebrating the namesake holiday. So here's a brief excerpt of the film for reference.
It was the night of the Valentine's Day dance at the Union Hall. The biggest event of the year. It had been a tradition for over 100 years. Everybody was there except for 7 miners who were out at the Hanniger mine. 5 of them, still down below. Two supervisors were waiting for the men to come up. Anxious to get to the party, they left before the men were safely out, failing to check the methane gas levels in the tunnels down below. The five men were buried alive as the town continued its party. For 6 weeks, we dug around the clock to try to save them. One man was found alive. Harry Warden spent the next year in the state mental hospital. Exactly 1 year later, on Valentine's Day, he came back to town. He killed the two supervisors who had left their post the year before. Then he cut out their hearts and stuffed them into heart-shaped candy boxes. That night at the dance, he found the boxes, blood dripping out the sides. Inside was a note, a warning from Harry, never to hold a Valentine's dance ever again.
The film My Bloody Valentine starts with a group of young and rowdy miners planning the town's first Valentine's dance since Harry Warden's murders. And just as the people feared, it seems Warden may be back.
From the heart comes a warning filled with bloody good cheer. Remember what happened as the 14th draws near.
It can't be happening again. It can't be.
During this episode of the Nighttime Podcast, we'll take a look back at this great film with two of those responsible for its success. First, we'll be joined by the director, George Mihalka. And then we'll hear from the male lead, Mr. Paul Kelman. He played the part of TJ. If you haven't already had the pleasure of watching My Bloody Valentine, I highly recommend you seek it out. But even if you haven't, that won't take away from the amusing stories our two guests will share about the production and the inspiration behind the film. So let's get to the content of our episode now. Our start will be my recent conversation with the director of My Bloody Valentine, Canada's own George Mihalka. For a lot of people like myself, filmmaking seems like a dream job. And again, I'm saying that as someone who's never done it. How did you get your start in filmmaking?
Well, it was a bit of a circuitous route. I studied literature in university, and in the process of doing that, I thought I'd do a master's degree in what was then called educational technology, which was basically a new program to teach potential teachers how to use media as a teaching tool. All along, I've always been interested in pictures and in art and painting. And one of the reasons, obviously, is when I first came to Canada, I didn't speak English or French. You know, so I did a lot of watching and drawing and spending my time observing more than I was doing, obviously, because I had a language issue. I had a roommate who was actually studying in the film department. So what happened was that I would help him out make his films, and he would help me make my videos. As I was about to graduate this program, the head of the fine arts department at Sir George Williams came to me and said, you know, this is kind of weird. You and this, you know, Rodney, actually the guy who ended up being the director of photography on My Bloody Valentine and many movies that I shot later, you guys seem to be winning a bunch of awards for my department, but you're not in it. Why not? Hmm. At the time, it was very difficult to get into the film school at Sir George. It was probably Concordia still is one of the premier film schools in the country. At the time, there was only like three. And it was very, very difficult to get into. And he offered me a position in the department where I didn't have to do any of the prerequisites, and I could go straight into year three of the four-year program. And I took him up on it and never looked back.
Right.
That's how it happened. Yeah. So Rodney and I kept making our student films, and we were fortunate enough to win a bunch of awards. And as I graduated from there, I got a job as a production assistant on a major feature film, where the production manager of that used to be one of the I guess, jurors of the Student Film Festival. So he knew me, I knew him. I said, you know, I'd really like to learn what the machine is. I can make my own films, but how does the big machine work? He said, well, we're going to be making one very soon, big French international co-production. If you want a job as a PA, come and get it, you know. So I did, and I kind of, and, you know, and really, really enjoyed it, and I ended up moving up from PA to assistant location manager and chief location scout for the film by the time we finished it. And the year later, this guy, Bob Presner, who ended up being the producer of Bloody Valentine, one of the producers of Bloody Valentine, called me and said, there's a producer in town who wants to make a comedy. And I used to do a lot of comedies as my student films. He said, you know, he's looking for a young director to make this sort of comedy about pinball.
Was this film Pickup Summer?
That's correct. Well, okay. Pinball Summer in Canada, Pickup Summer in the States.
Okay.
He said, you know, if you're interested, I could introduce you to him. So I said, sure, absolutely, you know, be happy to do so. I met the man, we got along, and next thing you know, I made that film. That brought me to the attention of John Dunning and Andre Link at Cinepix in Montreal. These are the guys who were doing all the Cronenberg movies, and they did Meatballs, you know, Big Hit, and so on. So they offered me a two-picture deal.
Okay, and so it was from the success of Pinball Summer that opened the door basically for you to take on. And I find it surprising that My Bloody Valentine ended up being your second picture, because it's a...
Well, so did I, because that's not what I was supposed to be making.
And it's a fairly intense horror movie, it seems like, to go from like kind of a teen comedy into this, which at the time pushed the boundaries pretty far.
That's right. Well, that was, again, an accident. My first picture with them, I had no idea what my second picture was going to be. You know, they asked me to start working on and developing a high-end comedy. I had, because of my literature background, I had some connections with some of the writers from the old days, the National Lampoon. We were going to make a comedy, a medical comedy this time, instead of a summer camp comedy called Stitches. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our head writer got ill. John called me into his office and said, look, George, you know, I don't want to let you down, but there's no way on earth that we're going to be able to make this film this year. How would you like to do your second film first? And I said, well, what's that? And he handed me a piece of paper, the one-page description of a story called The Secret, which was basically the outline of the story for My Bloody Valentine. And he said, you know, how would you like to make a horror film? And I said, I've never made one. He says, you never made a feature comedy until you made one either. You know, you're a good filmmaker. If you're interested, we need to start right away, because there's only one little problem, which is we need to have this film ready in 6 months' time. Because it needs to be in the theaters, 1,200 theaters for February. Oh, and in those days, obviously, you know, it took a month to just make all the release prints, you know, I mean, it was all 35 millimeter cans, right? I said yes, and John said, great, the young writer from LA will be up day after tomorrow. You start working on the storyline, get down to it. So that's kind of how it happened.
Wow. And so when you got involved with My Bloody Valentine, you were starting with basically you had about 5 months to film it, and you're given one page and the title isn't even there yet. So you just basically had like a rough outline of what the story would be?
Yeah. It's the story of My Bloody Valentine. You know, it's exactly the story, but imagine telling that story in a page.
Yeah. And you know, one thing I've always wondered about it, I find the name My Bloody Valentine so striking. And you mentioned at first it was called The Secret. Who came up with this name?
Oh, John already had that name in mind. He was just not going to let anybody else know.
Okay.
You know, I think that's why he decided to call it The Secret.
Okay. It makes sense.
You know, yeah, he didn't want anybody to say, oh, shit, you know, Fitfix was making a Valentine movie. Let's beat them to the punch. It was called Secret Productions. It was called The Secret all the way through. It wasn't rebaptized or it wasn't given its real name until we put it on the titles.
Interesting. Given the success of Friday the 13th and Halloween, I can understand the motivation to do a holiday-themed movie, like with this being the Valentine's theme. But it just seems like an unusual choice to decide to set the movie within a coal mine. I'm assuming that was already determined and that was already planned when you got in?
You know, I mean, when we first read the thing, you know, he said, well, what do you guys think of the coal mine? And we said, fuck yeah. You know, this is exactly it. Because, you know, at the time, my favorite movie of the time, and so was Rodney's and Bob Presner's too, and eventually we found that John Baird's, was The Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
So we just said, hell, you know, being again young and totally ambitious, you know, we just said, okay, we're going to go out and make The Deer Hunter of horror movies. Funnily enough, that's what Tarantino called it, you know. So it was a very large budget picture for those days. Most slasher movies now are made for a couple $1 million. We made that for 2.8 back 40 years ago, 35 years ago.
And when it compares to Friday the 13th and Halloween or any of its contemporaries, your budget was almost quadruple theirs. I'm guessing that's a sign that the producers had a lot of faith in what you were doing and that it was going to be a success?
Yeah, Paramount thought it was going to be a success. We all thought it was going to be a success. You know, I mean, you know, as much as you can, you know, I mean, if everyone knew what a success is going to be, there wouldn't be any unsuccessful movies, right?
Yeah.
It's such an inexact science, but they just assumed that it was going to, you know, do well. A lot of the money obviously also went into the state-of-the-art special effects, because the whole idea here was to push special effects to its absolute limits.
And was this a plan during the production that you were intentionally going to push the boundaries with the realism and the gore?
Oh yeah, that was right off the top. And we all agreed that we wanted to do was to make the horror, make the violence real and hurt. Now, we didn't want to do beauty shots. We didn't want to do beer commercials of blood. Mm. We wanted that to hurt. We wanted that to look real. You know, a lot of it was planned on being able to do it in one shot without having to have the guy strike towards the camera with his pickaxe and then seeing it already arrive in somebody with a sound effect. We wanted to do it all in one, which was ended up being our downfall.
How was that?
Well, what happened was when the film got finished, and we had to send it to the Motion Picture Association of America for ratings, they looked at the film and they said, forget it. This is an X-rated movie. You got to cut stuff out. And Paramount, obviously, with the kind of money that they invested, and John, obviously, too, you know, they said, well, we can't afford to have an X-rated movie. You know, in those days, an X-rated movie went into the 150 porno theaters. So the Motion Picture Association of America told us that this needs to be cut out, that needs to be cut out, this needs to be cut out, to the point where we ended up having to send an editor to Los Angeles with a work copy who would then screen it and then tell us what we needed to cut out. But once a negative is cut, you can't put it back together again.
Not like in Photoshop where you can just hit undo.
Yeah. When you cut it, it's cut and you lose a frame.
Yeah.
So, which would then mean a jump.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go back to whatever we had, and we had to figure out a way of satisfying the MPAA, who basically ended up killing us with we died the death of 1,000 cuts. This drama went on for 2 weeks, where literally at one point, they said, well, you still need to cut out 3 frames of something. And we said, well, there's nothing left. And then we realized John again and everybody else, we wanted to have the best available sound. And so you would hear the pickaxe pierce the skin, then crack the cartilage, then reach soft tissue, you know, and everything had a sound. Well, we realized that our sound was so goddamn strong and powerful We were asked to cut out pictures when there was nothing left but sound. So unfortunately, like I said, you know, our big plan to amaze and blow everyone's minds away with the fabulous special effects kind of backfired.
Yeah, and I understand that it was the climate for violence in movies was a little odd then. What was the reason that the MPAA was so hard on this film?
Well, one of the reasons was, and you know, it's a theory, and some people have purported, you know, I kind of tend to agree with it. Early December, John Lennon got killed, and there was an incredible backlash against gratuitous violence. Filmmaking, and especially in Hollywood and everywhere else to an extent, is a business. It's an industry. So they don't want to necessarily fly in the face of public sentiment at the time.
It makes sense.
The same way when John Belushi died, nobody did drugs in Hollywood and drugs were bad. And there were no drug movies for at least 6 months. Well, the same thing happened to us, you know. Friday the 13th, Part 2 came out a few months after, I think in May, and I looked at it and said, holy shit. The other problem, I think, was also two of the highest grossing movies of that year were Canadian movies. One being Meatballs, which set a record for the highest grossing comedy of all time at that time, and then right afterwards, Porky's. Canadians were making big money. The vested interest wasn't there to allow Canadians to make. So whether that is true or not, I don't know. All I know is that the local productions of horror 3 months later didn't have the same problems we did.
Interesting. Now, what led to the movie being shot in Sydney Mines? Now, Sydney Mines is a small town in Nova Scotia where I don't know of anything else that has ever happened there other than the filming of My Bloody Valentine. How did this turn out to be?
Well, basically, we were looking for coal mines, right? You know, there's some in Alberta and there's some in Cape Breton Island. We found out that Princess Mine in North Sydney was, or was it Sydney Mine, was just been decommissioned. That was a time when a lot of those jobs were being lost, right?
Absolutely.
That was part of the subtext of Bloody Valentine. So that sort of fit in with the world over there. The town was absolutely picturesque and reminded us of in a strange way of the Deer Hunter. We loved the bleakness of it. And obviously the fact that we had access to a fabulous working mine with, you know, I mean, an incredible production value, something that if you were going to recreate would have been, you know, in the millions and tens of millions of dollars even then. Mm-hmm. And all we have to do is ride down the elevator.
And now you mentioned the town economically wasn't doing well. Lots of people were losing their jobs. I'm assuming that the people of Sydney Mines in North Sydney must have been delighted to see a major production like My Bloody Valentine being shot there. How did the community react to the attention of all the cameras coming in?
No, the community was amazing. You know, I mean, we were able to hire so many people. Most of our support staff were locals. We had an opportunity to hire the pioneers of the budding film industry in Halifax. We ended up being there for close to 3 months. So we filled one of the hotels in Sydney, the one with the cool bar and the music, which name I can't remember. And this is off season too, right? You know, by the time we showed up, whatever tourists want to do the Cabot Trail were long gone. So obviously it was an economic boost to the town just from, you know, the paint stores, the carpentry shops, the lumber yards, the car rentals, name it.
And I heard a story, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that the town tried to clean up a bit and maybe set the production back. Can you tell me that story?
Oh, that was so wonderful. We decided that, yeah, this is it. You know, this is where we can shoot it. You know, we've had, you know, we checked out all the logistics, we checked out everything to do. Basically, Bob Presner, myself, Penny Hadfield, the production designer, we just said, okay, so this is it. So Bob obviously made, you know, made some arrangements that we would be coming back in 3 weeks' time to start prepping and then shooting, and everyone was very thrilled with us coming back. And I guess the town decided, or the locals in the mine, that they didn't want to show the Princess Mine being as dirty and kind of tired as it was. So they went out and they painted the whole damn thing. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we showed up, and literally it looked like a mindset from a Walt Disney movie. And obviously we said, oh my God, what are we going to do with this?
Yeah, not exactly from Deer Hunter.
Yeah, we ended up hiring just about anybody who could hold a paintbrush. Brought in a couple of high-end scenic painters from Montreal to train them. And we had to repaint and dirty down the whole thing.
Oh, you God.
Know? I mean, all the rust you see there is painted on.
Yeah, painted on over paint, probably covering natural rust below the prior
exactly.
layer.
Exactly. So, yeah, that put us back. The amount I heard was somewhere around $50,000.
Oh, good God!
So yeah, we were sort of $50,000 over budget before we did anything.
Now, given that the movie, again, it had a big budget, the plan was for this to be an international success. Was there ever discussions about the movie being too Canadian with like the accents and the sets? Like as I'm watching it, it feels really Canadian, and it reminds me of like I grew up near where this is filmed, and it just seems so Nova Scotia to me. Was that something you discussed?
Well, basically, the idea was that as long as we didn't show Canadian flags or show Canadian money,
there was a lot of Canadian beer.
There's only one Canadian beer in there called Moosehead.
Yeah, but in almost every scene, it seems.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. The thing was, beer drinking is one of the, it's a prerequisite to be a miner.
Yeah.
But Moosehead, we just love the name. It kind of reminded us again a little bit of the Deer Hunter. Well, this was Moose Hunter. You know? We figured, and we were right on that at the time, nobody knew Moosehead. In the States, they thought we made it up, or they thought it was some strange beer somewhere from, out east or whatever. They assumed that this was going to be taking place.
Yeah, good point. I just always wondered if that was something people were concerned about.
No, they weren't concerned about it. And basically, again, it was something that we consciously did, and we thought, we're going to be comfortable with this. You know, we don't need to show flags, the only time you see a lot of flags in an American movie when it was made in Canada, pretending to be America. Luckily enough, we didn't have to worry about many flags because Canada is not a flag waving country. But on the other hand, we said, we're Canadians, we're making this movie in Canada. And so there, and it was just not a concern for us. And we kind of laughed about it, giggled about it, the fact that we got away with all these guys with East Coast accents and drinking Moosehead.
Yeah.
We thought that was always our end joke. We were never shy. And we're always proud of the fact that it's Canadian. So I'm going to fuck you.
Now,
you're here to watch the horror.
Yeah, that's right. Forget about the accents. Now, a couple more questions I had about the production. One of them is in this movie particularly, the deaths, the death scenes and the killings, they're so creative. How, like during the production of the film, how do you come up with the ways that people meet their end in a movie like this?
Well, there was a few things. Obviously, you look at the weapons available, you look at the situations and where they happen. We knew that Harry Warden was going to have a pickaxe and he's going to have a knife, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he kills them with the pickaxe and cuts their hearts out with a knife. So what we did was when we came back, you know, I mean, the story was written, the script was written. The last thing we did was to finalize how these kills are going to happen. Once we came back with the pictures of the locations and of the you know, the potential sets and so on. For instance, the famous scene where Cynthia gets impaled on the shower head.
Yes.
That literally came out of the fact that I visited the locker room and showers of the mine and noticed that there were no shower heads. They were all just cut off pipes crimped at the end to create a spray. They were sharp. Then the other thing I noticed while I was there is, you know, first time I walked in, it was like her saying, what are those things hanging on the ceiling? Well, those were the clothes of the miners, right? Because they take those hot, sweaty clothes off, hang them on a hook, and then bring them 20 feet up into the air where they would dry. So the next day, they'd lower them down, and they would be dry and workable again, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I went back, and we had a little camera with us, and, you know, I shot the clothes coming down. I said, look, that's so cool. And look at us. We could have her impaled on one of these and turn her head into a shower head. You know. So, and John said, Now you're thinking, son.
Yeah. One I have to ask about is the guy who got his face dunked in the boiling hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine where that came from.
Well, that was nice. that was the Union Hall, right? Not the Union Hall, but it was the cafeteria of the mine. So it had an industrial kitchen, and it had these huge big pots. And we needed to kill somebody there because we needed to have that dead body found in the freezer. So I said, how about if he boils his face off? And we could put a camera underneath and put a plexiglass on bottom of the pot and throw in some dry ice and air bubbles to make it look like it's boiling, throw in some hot dogs to float around in front of his face. And then Tom Berman said, yeah, and I've been just working on these time delay makeup compounds where we could actually put 7 layers of makeup on him. And within 40 seconds or so, the water should dissolve one after the other and bubble it up and make it look like it's boiling. So I said, how cool is that? Let's do it. Obviously, that got cut out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, basically, that was a 30-some-odd second scene where you actually saw the guy because we timed out how long he could hold his breath. Then we worked backwards from that to time out how long it would take for the for all the makeup to dissolve and wear off and make it look like he's got boiled. And then we shot it. And then, again, it was in one shot.
Yeah, an incredible shot. Mainly, it is very realistic looking. I find the makeup in this film, especially given its time, again, filmed in 81, so realistic. From the hot dog scene, I found very, very good. Also, the lady found in the dryer, in the laundromat mm-hmm. scene, that I almost, even now, as somebody who's watched every horror movie there's ever been, I'm sure, I even almost had to look away. It looked so realistic. Especially seeing it in Blu-ray, a lot of these older films, when you see them in high definition now, you kind of see the warts and all kind of thing. But in My Bloody Valentine, I really didn't have that experience. I found it, you know, was perfect.
Yeah, yeah. No, we spent a lot of time and a lot of money on that. That one was written original. You know, that one wasn't made up because of the location. We knew we were going to need a laundromat, and we just thought, there was some news articles recently about somebody who locked a kid into an industrial dryer, and the kid got, you know, sort of dehydrated and baked. So we thought, oh, that sounds interesting. Let's do that to Mabel.
God. Now, I don't know if this is a part of the creative vision or if maybe I'm thinking it had something to do with all the cuts, but I find when I was rewatching it from the Blu-ray, whenever there's a violent scene, it would seem like kind of like an effect was put on the film. It was kind of like a bit brighter, a bit higher contrast. Was there something done intentionally, or what is that?
What happened was all those scenes, when I remember everyone was telling me about how with negatives, you can't put stuff back.
Yeah.
These scenes were lost for 30 years or 28 years. Everything that got cut out of the movie got lost. It must have been around 2000 that Paramount and John Dunning called and said, would you like to do a director's cut? We think we may have found some of the footage to be able to restore it to what it was originally intended to be. Well, unfortunately, that footage was in powder form. You know, film when it's not negative, when it's not taken care of very well, tends to disintegrate very quickly. Mm-hmm. So we could never do that. About 6 years later or so, John and Andre Ling were retiring, and they sold their company to Lionsgate, and they were emptying out their warehouses. And in a locker that hasn't been opened in 25 years or so, some reels of film were found, which were basically not negative, but the work prints of some of the scenes that were cut out.
And these are the scenes that were cut out back when the MPAA got their hands on it.
Yeah. Well, about 50% of them. The rest are gone.
Okay. You know,
the rest will never be seen. So this what you're seeing now is everything that could be salvaged. Now, when we were putting it together, they basically came to me and said, look, you know, there's only so far we can go in restoring these dirty old positive images. There's no way on earth that we're going to be able to make these fit seamlessly. And the best they could come up with was quite unsatisfactory. So then we all decided, well, you know what? Most people want to know what got cut out of the film. So why don't we leave it with less artifact and actually put it in the way, you know, where we can cut it the best and use the sound and use the editing, as opposed to trying to make it all look exactly the same, visually seamless.
Okay.
So yes, it was done on purpose.
So if it was 1982 or 81 and I go to the theater to see the movie, I would have seen everything up to when that different look.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, because that was one of my theories, because I was trying to guess what it was, and a part of me thought maybe the idea was, you know, this was Warden's point of view, but then my other theory was that this is you just re-adding the stuff that was previously cut, because it seems to, like, that kind of look happens when the gore really starts to come on, so.
Exactly.
That explains it.
Strangely enough, it kind of works.
Yeah, and I think that the average person would probably watch the Blu-ray not even realizing that effect happens. I went to school for photography, so I have a good eye for it, so I picked it up pretty quick, but I think the average person would be oblivious to it. And the people who are, you know, the devotees of this movie, because again, it has such a cult following, that's what, when we get a Blu-ray of an older movie like this, that's what we're buying it. We're looking for, you know, the extra little content and the director's commentary. So it was a great decision.
Exactly.
A great decision to add it. Now, one thing I was wondering is the ending of the movie, it seems to perfectly set up a sequel. And again, comparing the movie to its contemporaries like Friday the 13th and Halloween, those movies were kind of based on, you know, every movie ending with kind of something that can be picked up in the next movie. It seems to me like you may have been trying to do that with My Bloody Valentine. Was there talks at the time for a part two?
Not really. You know, I mean, I think we kind of wanted to leave it open-ended only because we thought that it was going to be much more creepy. Mm-hmm. Knowing that this guy might survive. Sequels to movies really came in with Friday the 13th. For us, we just found it to be kind of satisfying that it wasn't a happy ending, you know, a fully happy ending, you know, I mean, a couple of people survived, great, but the menace remains. So that's the reason why. And we just wanted to have that one last scare when Sarah ends up, you know, ripping his arm out of the hole.
And what about the 2009 remake? I don't believe you're involved in that in any way, were you?
No, I wasn't involved at all in that movie.
I'm curious how it feels to have been so involved with a horror movie like this that has had over the years such a cult following. It's so highly regarded. I'm just wondering, for you as a filmmaker, how it feels to have made an impact on the horror genre in the way that you have.
You know, I take it as an honor. You know, I mean, basically, you get a very good sense of satisfaction and, in a sense, an affirmation or a vindication of all the decisions you made back then, that, yeah, it worked. You know, I mean, I found it to be a major compliment. My usual comment on the remake is this. Since people started making movies, you know, 110 years ago or whatever, when the industry actually became an industry, right? How many movies have been made? Minimum a couple of 100,000. How many have been remade? A couple of 100? Mm-hmm. Maybe. What greater compliment?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Only the best get remade.
Yeah, I think so. As well as when the remake came out, I think a lot of people probably then went and discovered the 1981 version for the first time. So,
well, I think so. You know, I mean, what happened? You know, I mean, Valentine had that kind of strange life. In the mid 90s, a whole new generation discovered it because an Irish art punk band decided to name themselves after us.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. How does that work? Like, is there a copyright type of stuff that would cause a problem?
No, you can never copy. You can't copyright a title.
Okay.
You can have seven movies with the same title. So, and why would we want to copyright? You know, why would we? A whole audience worldwide of people who are into cool artsy punk music made us discover the movie. So by the late 90s, whole new audience, you know, so that grew. Then obviously then Tarantino comes out and says it's his favorite slasher film, you know, so that obviously, again, and one of the interesting things, which horror fans tend to be true cinephiles. A horror fan, if they have not seen the original, won't go see the remake. Or if they only saw the remake, they will go and find the original to see it. You know, mm-hmm. There's a great sense of respect from horror fans that I've always found, you know, just awesome and so complimentary. And, you know, there's a reverence to the art. So obviously, a whole new group of horror fans, again, rediscovered it. It was just wonderful to hear so many of them, you know, and all the blogs and so on saying, you know, I mean, you know, you'll love the original more. It definitely gave the original another life. You know, it's sort of like, you know, it's on its fourth life. You know, I'm hoping we'll reach nine before I die. You know.
The conversation you just heard with George was a complete delight, easily one of the favorites I've had for the podcast. And as a result of the behind-the-scenes details he shared, the love I have for my favorite Valentine's movie grows even stronger. Now, before we get to our next guest, let's take a moment to hear about an exciting new way you can help support the Nighttime Podcast. Listeners of the Nighttime Podcast, if you or someone you care about has hard-to-manage hair, take this as both an advertisement and a public service announcement. During my life with Mrs. Bone Party, I've become accustomed to planning our days around her complicated beauty regimen that, to me, seems to just be 45 minutes of spraying, blow-drying, and straightening her hair. And worst part is, sometimes this happens twice in a day. But since she found Monate's hair products, this all changed. No longer does a trip to the grocery store include extended periods of me treading water in the living room as she does something I don't understand to her hair. Let me ask her to explain it to you. So you beat yourself up and agonized over whether or not you're going to spend the money on Monate. So you bought it, you've used it for a month, Has it been worth it?
It totally has. If I decide to leave my hair air dry right out of the shower, my natural curl looks great with no frizz. If I do decide to blow dry and straighten it, it takes way less time and my hair looks better than it ever has. I don't know how it works, but I have tried literally every product there is and nothing has made my hair look like this.
Well, there you have it. If you want to try Monate for yourself and support the Nighttime Podcast at the same time, visit mymonate.com/nighttime. And that's mymonate.com/nighttime. Welcome back. Next, we're going to hear from Mr. Paul Kelman. He was the male lead in My Bloody Valentine. His character was TJ Henniger, the son of the mine owner. Now, during my talk with Paul, he provides some perspective of what life was like on the set, and will tell the story about the two people who almost actually did die during the production, and the legal battle that followed. The clip will start with Paul explaining how he got involved with the production of My Bloody Valentine.
We were just finishing doing a film called Gaff, which was a comedy. It was also by Paramount. And Keith Knight had an audition. He told me about it. He said, I'm going to audition for this horror movie for this director that I've worked for before. Keith Knight played Hollis, if you remember, with the big mustache.
Oh, yeah.
He was going, and he turned around to me and he said, well, listen, I'm going to this audition. You want to come? He said, you want to crash it? So I said, okay. So he took me along, and then when he was finished auditioning for George, he said, well, listen, I brought another guy, actor from the movie I'm doing right now. He said, would you like to see him? He's pretty good, blah, blah, blah. You know, he was very, very generous, Keith. And so I went in, and they saw me, and they cast me right there on the spot. That was it.
Can you tell me a little bit about the filming of the movie and just kind of like what it was like on the set and what it was like back then?
We, you know, like it wasn't something that we were, like most of us were familiar with. I mean, mining. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had to do some research. We went down to the face at Grace Bay and we talked to a lot of miners and met a lot of families. And that kind of gave us the flavor of the kind of people that risk their lives mining. And so we kind of had a sense of all of that by the time that we started shooting. The actual shoot itself, first of all, the mine is, I think, 600 feet beneath the ocean floor, which is only one of two coastal mines in North America. And I think it's the deepest one in terms of as far as the ocean goes. So that was kind of daunting because it would take, I don't know, 7 minutes in the elevator to get down and get back up.
Wow.
Which is a long time. And then they had to bring all the equipment down and bring all the equipment back up and all the lights and everything. So it was really a fairly complicated process. And also, you're down there for hours and hours at a time, way down in the mine. And there's no smoking, of course, and there were a few smokers on people who smoke. And so what we did was, we chewed tobacco, just like miners do. And we had to learn how to do that because that's not exactly an easy thing to do without throwing up. If you make a mistake and swallow some, which did happen, you know. And, of course, you got, you know, a dirty black mouth and everything. And, you know, you ended up kind of actually experiencing what it was like to some extent, like for real, you know, because it's dusty, it's some of it is really cramped. Other parts were wide open. But you get a real feel of it riding the cars up and down. You've got all the same things that miners use, like pickaxes and things. And, you know, you're wielding those. So, yeah, we got a pretty good flavor of the actuality of the thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that came across.
Oh, definitely. You know? And you mentioned about some of the hazards and just how dangerous some aspects of the filming were. I heard a story about a dangerous situation you found yourself in a rented Camaro that the film production was using. Can you tell me what happened with this Camaro?
It's hard to say exactly what went wrong, but from my point of view, I was driving the Camaro. We were racing out of the mining yard, and we did a dry run. Then we did the actual shoot, it was kind of weird. Along the path that we were driving out really quickly, we were gunning it out of there about four or five vehicles. An extra had been placed in front of a parked car. And as I was gunning it out of the yard, he was there kind of in front of me all of a sudden. And I thought everything would be okay. I saw that there was a little rock sticking out of the ground. And I hit the rock with the left wheel of the car. And instead of the rock, me just running over the rock and the rock getting shunted aside, it didn't move. It was just the tip of a boulder underneath the ground. So when the car hit the tip of the boulder, the boulder didn't move, mm-hmm. of course, but the car did. So the car went flying up in the air. And I was propelled up in the air. And I couldn't control it as I landed. I hit him. He went flying up in the air and landed somewhere. I almost ran over him the second time. I veered as quickly as I could out of the way. And I ended up running into a frost fence. Wow. And actually, I was going to be cut in half by the pole. At the last second, I thought, well, I'll use the fence as a glove to catch me. So that's what I did, and I went smack into the fence, and it caught me like a net.
Wow!
But I was quite injured at the time. It was a really big to-do, and of course the guy who I hit was the guy who owned the car that I was driving, and after that we had this big to-do between the film company, the guy who got hit, and myself. Everybody started suing everybody.
Oh, wow.
But it was really quite comical, really, because he thought, I suppose, that we're just like big actors from Ontario. we were like big names and we had a lot of money and all that. So he sued me for $1 million. Oh. I mean, no one had $1 million. In the end, the people most responsible are always the film company, and they ended up paying out whatever. It wasn't anywhere near $1 million or anything like that. But they took responsibility, which I thought was the right thing to do. So
exactly.
In the end, they came through.
There's one scene in the movie I can picture is when you're all off work at the mines and you're ready to go party and you just get in your car and you all take off tearing up the road. Is that the scene?
That's it. Everybody was pretty. It was pretty lucky, fortunate, really, that nobody got killed, including me.
Yeah, it sounds it. With this movie, it seems like an ambitious plot, again, to take a Valentine's Day theme, make a horror movie set in a mine. It just seems ambitious. And to me, it almost seems like it's something that shouldn't have worked and shouldn't have been so successful. Now, as a member of the cast, what did you expect the reaction to be while it was being filmed? Did you expect it to be something that now, 35 years later, we're talking about?
Not at all. Nobody had a clue about that. In fact, I'd forgotten all about the film up until about three years ago. And then all of a sudden, I was on Facebook, and all of a sudden I got all these friends requests from people who I didn't know. And they found me on Facebook. So now I have quite a constituency of fans and people who just love the movie. It's, it was a big surprise to me. I mean, really, I had absolutely no idea that it had become even recognized as anything at all. But, I stopped acting around 1990. I'd only done altogether, I think I've done maybe 7 or 8 films mm-hmm. altogether. I was an early adapter to computers, mm-hmm. Way back. So that really got me excited. And so I started my first technology company in the 90s. I started the first virtual reality company in Canada.
Oh, wow.
So that was my focus for the next 10 years after that. So the film part of my career was only about 8 years or so. And so that was a small, a lesser part of my life, And like I said, I really didn't see this thing coming until about 2-3 years ago.
That will conclude part one of a two-part series covering My Bloody Valentine. In my next episode, I'm very excited to be joined by two popular guests from the world of podcasting to discuss the film and the horror genre in general. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, please check out my Patreon group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to monthly bonus content. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. On behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the current patrons and welcome Aaron, the newest member to the group. Without you all, the production of the show would be impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on whichever podcast platform you use. To stay up to date with the show, please visit my website, nighttimepodcast.com. Follow me on Facebook, as well as I'm on Twitter and Instagram, where I have the handle @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or any feedback for the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you all again soon.